but it is my hope I can at least offer you some balm for your pain." He laid his hand upon his chest. "I bring you justice. I bring you the head of your Valonqua." The old Valyrian word sent a chill through her, though it also gave her a tingle of hope. "The imp is no longer my brother, if he ever was," she declared. "Nor will I say his name. It was a proud name once, before he dishonored it. In Tyrosh we name him Red Hands, for the blood running from his fingers, a king's blood and a father's. Some say he slew his mother, too, ripping his way from her womb with savage claws." "What nonsense," Circe thought. "'Tis true," she said. "If the imp's head is in that chest, I shall raise you to lordship and grant you rich lands and keeps. Titles were cheaper than dirt, and the riverlands were full of ruined castles standing desolate amidst untended fields and burned villages. My court awaits. Open the box and let us see." The Tyroshi threw open the box with a flourish and stepped back, smiling. Within, the head of a dwarf reposed upon a bed of soft blue velvet, staring up at her. Circe took a long look. "That is not my brother." There was a sour taste in her mouth. I suppose it was too much to hope for, especially after Loras. The gods are never that good. "This man has brown eyes. Tyrion had one black eye and one green."
"The eyes, just so.
Your Grace, your brother's own eyes had somewhat decayed. I took the liberty of replacing them with glass, but of the wrong color, as you say." That only annoyed her further. "Your head may have glass eyes, but I do not. There are gargoyles on Dragonstone that look more like the imp than this creature. He's bald, and twice my brother's age. What happened to his teeth?" The man shrank before the fury in her voice. "He had a fine set of gold teeth, Your Grace, but I regret."
"Oh, not yet. But you will.
I ought to have him strangled. Let him gasp for breath until his face turns black, the way my sweet son did." The words were on her lips. "An honest mistake. One dwarf looks so much like another, and Your Grace will observe he has no nose." "He has no nose because you cut it off."
"No."
The sweat on his brow gave the lie to his denial.
"Yes."
A poisonous sweetness crept into Circe's tone.
"At least you had that much sense.
The last fool tried to tell me that a hedge wizard had regrown it. Still, it seems to me that you owe this dwarf a nose. House Lannister pays its debts, and so shall you. Sir Merin, take this fraud to Qyburn." Sir Merin Trant took the Tyroshi by the arm and hauled him off, still protesting. When they were gone, Circe turned to Osmond Kettleblack.
"Sir Osmond, get this thing out of my sight, and bring in the other three who claim knowledge of the imp."
"Aye, Your Grace."
Sad to say, the three would-be informers proved no more useful than the Tyroshi. One said that the imp was hiding in an old town brothel, pleasuring men with his mouth. It made for a droll picture, but Circe did not believe it for an instant. The second claimed to have seen the dwarf in a mummer's show in Braavos. The third insisted Tyrion had become a hermit in the Riverlands, living on some haunted hill. The queen made the same response to each.
"If you will be so good as to lead some of my brave knights to this dwarf, you shall be richly rewarded," she promised, "provided that it is the imp. If not, well, my knights have little patience for deception, nor fools who send them chasing after shadows. A man could lose his tongue."
And quick as that, all three informers suddenly lost faith and allowed that perhaps it might have been some other dwarf they saw. Circe had never realized that there were so many dwarfs. "Is the whole world overrun with these twisted little monsters?" she complained, whilst the last of the informers was being ushered out. "How many of them can there be?"
"Fewer than there were," said Lady Merryweather. "May I have the honor of accompanying Your Grace to court?"
"If you can bear the tedium," said Circe. "Robert was a fool about most things, but he was right in one regard. It is wearisome work to rule a kingdom.
It saddens me to see Your Grace so careworn.
I say run off and play, and leave the king's hands to hear these tiresome petitions. We could dress as serving girls and spend the day amongst the small folk, to hear what they are saying of the fall of Dragonstone. I know the inn where the blue bard plays when he is not singing attendance on the little queen, and a certain cellar where a conjurer turns lead into gold, water into wine, and girls into boys. Perhaps he would work his spells on the two of us. Would it amuse your grace to be a man one night? If I were a man, I would be Jamie, the queen thought. If I were a man, I could rule this realm in my own name in place of Tommen's. Only if you remained a woman, she said, knowing that was what Taena wanted to hear. You are a wicked thing to tempt me so. But what sort of queen would I be if I put my realm in the trembling hands of Harry Swift? Taena pouted. Your grace is too diligent. I am, Circe allowed, and by day's end I shall rue it. She slipped her arm through Lady Merriweather's. Come. Jalabar Joe was the first to petition her that day, as befit his rank as a prince in exile. Splendid as he looked in his bright feathered cloak, he had only come to beg. Circe let him make his usual plea for men and arms to help him regain Red Flower Vale, then said, His grace is fighting his own war, Prince Jalabar. He has no men to spare for yours just now. Next year, perhaps. That was what Robert always told him. Next year she would tell him never, but not today. Dragonstone was hers. Lord Halline of the Guild of Alchemists presented himself to ask that his pyromancers be allowed to hatch any dragon's eggs that might turn up upon Dragonstone, now that the isle was safely back in royal hands. If any such eggs remained, Stannis would have sold them to pay for his rebellion, the queen told him. She refrained from saying that the plan was mad. Ever since the last Targaryen dragon had died, all such attempts had ended in death, disaster, or disgrace. A group of merchants appeared before her to beg the throne to intercede for them with the Iron Bank of Braavos. The Braavosi were demanding repayment of their outstanding debts, it seemed, and refusing all new loans. We need our own bank, Circe decided, the Golden Bank of Lannisport. Perhaps when Tommen's throne was secure, she could make that happen. For the nonce, all she could do was tell the merchants to pay the Braavosi usurers their due. The delegation from the Faith was headed by our old friend Septon Reynard. Six of the warrior's sons escorted him across the city. Together they were seven, a holy and propitious number. The new High Septon, or High Sparrow, as Moon Boy had dubbed him, did everything by sevens. The knights wore sword belts, striped in the seven colours of the faith. Crystals adorned the pommels of their long swords and the crests of their great helms. They carried kite shields of a style not common since the conquest, displaying a device not seen in the Seven Kingdoms for centuries, a rainbow sword shining bright upon a field of darkness. Close to 100 knights had already come forth to pledge their lives and swords to the warrior's sons, Kyburn claimed, and more turned up every day. Drunk on the gods, the lot of them. Who would have thought the realm contained so many of them? Most had been household knights and hedge knights, but a handful were of high birth, younger sons, petty lords, old men wanting to atone for the old sins. And then there was Lancel. She had thought Kyburn must be japing when he had told her that her mooncalf cousin had forsaken castle, lands, and wife and wandered back to the city to join the noble and puissant order of the warrior's sons. Yet there he stood, with the other pious fools. Circe liked that not at all, nor was she pleased by the High Sparrow's endless truculence and ingratitude. "Where is the High Septon?" she demanded of Reynard. "It was him I summoned." Septon Reynard assumed a regretful tone. "His High Holiness sent me in his stead, and bade me tell your grace that the seven have sent him forth to battle wickedness." "How? By preaching chastity along the Street of Silk? Does he think praying over whores will turn them back to virgins? Our bodies were shaped by our father and mother, so we might join male to female and beget true-born children," Reynard replied. "It is base and sinful for women to sell their holy parts for coin." The pious sentiment would have been more convincing if the Queen had not known that Septon Reynard had special friends in every brothel on the Street of Silk. No doubt he had decided that echoing the high sparrow's twitterings was preferable to scrubbing floors. "Do not presume to preach at me," she told him. "The brothel keepers have been complaining, and rightly so." "If sinners speak, why should the righteous listen? These sinners feed the royal coffers," the Queen said bluntly, "and their pennies help pay the wages of my gold cloaks and build galleys to defend our shores. There is trade to be considered as well. If King's Landing had no brothels, the ships would go to Duskendale or Gulltown. His High Holiness promised me peace in my streets. Whoring helps to keep that peace. Common men deprived of whores are apt to turn to rape. Henceforth, let His High Holiness do his praying in the sept where it belongs." The Queen had expected to hear from Lord Giles as well, but instead Grand Maester Pycelle appeared, grey-faced and apologetic, to tell her that Rosby was too weak to leave his bed. "Sad to say, I fear Lord Giles must join his noble forebears soon. May the Father judge him justly. If Rosby dies, Mace Tyrell and the little Queen will try and force Garth the Gross on me again. Lord Giles has had that cough for years, and it never killed him before," she complained. "He coughed through half of Robert's reign and all of Joffrey's. If he is dying now, it can only be because someone wants him dead." Grand Maester Pycelle blinked in disbelief. "Your Grace, who would want Lord Giles dead? His heir, perhaps? Or the little Queen? Some woman he once scorned? Marjorie and Mace and the Queen of Thorns, why not? Giles is in their way. An old enemy? A new one? You!" The old man blanched. "Your Grace, Japes, I have purged his lordship, bled him, treated him with poultices and infusions. The mists give him some relief, and sweet sleep helps the violence of his coughing. But he is bringing up bits of lung with the blood now, I fear. Be that as it may, you will return to Lord Giles and inform him that he does not have my leave to die. If it please your Grace." Pycelle bowed stiffly. There was more and more and more, each petitioner more boring than the last. And that evening, when the last of them had finally gone and she was eating a simple supper with her son, she told him, "Tommen, when you say your prayers before bed, tell the mother and the father that you are thankful you are still a child. Being king is hard work. I promise you, you will not like it. They peck at you like a murder of crows. Everyone wants a piece of your flesh." "Yes, mother," said Tommen in a sad tone. The little Queen had told him of Sir Loras, she understood. Sir Osmond said the boy had wept. "He is young. By the time he is Joff's age, he will not recall what Loras looked like." "I wouldn't mind them pecking, though," her son went on to say. "I should go to court with you every day to listen. Marjorie says a deal too much," Circe snapped. "For half a groat, I'd gladly have her tongue torn out." "Don't you say that," Tommen shouted suddenly, his round little face turning red. "You leave her tongue alone. Don't you touch her. I'm the king, not you." She stared at him, incredulous. "What did you say?" "I'm the king. I get to say who has their tongue torn out, not you. I won't let you hurt Marjorie. I won't. I forbid it." Circe took him by the ear and dragged him squealing to the door, where she found Sir Boros Blount standing guard. "Sir Boros, His Grace has forgotten himself. Kindly escort him to his bedchamber and bring up Pate. This time I want Tommen to whip the boy himself. He is to continue until the boy is bleeding from both cheeks. If His Grace refuses or says one word of protest, summon Kyburn and tell him to remove Pate's tongue so His Grace can learn the cost of insolence." "As you command," Sir Boros huffed, glancing at the king uneasily. "Your Grace, please come with me." As night fell over the Red Keep, Jocelyn kindled a fire in the Queen's hearth, whilst Dorcas lit the bedside candles. Circe opened the window for a breath of air and found that the clouds had rolled back in to hide the stars. "Such a dark night, Your Grace," murmured Dorcas. "Aye," she thought, "but not so dark as in the Maiden Vault, or on Dragonstone where Loras Tyrell lies burned and bleeding, or down in the black cells beneath the castle." The Queen did not know why that occurred to her. She had resolved not to give Felice another thought. Single combat. Felice should have known better than to marry such a fool. The word from Stokeworth was that Lady Tanda had died of a chill in the chest, brought on by her broken hip. Lolly's Lackwit had been proclaimed Lady Stokeworth, with Sir Bronn her lord. Tanda dead and Giles dying. It is well that we have Moon, boy, or the court would be entirely bereft of fools. The Queen smiled as she lay her head upon the pillow. When I kissed her cheek, I could taste the salt of her tears. She dreamt an old dream of three girls in brown cloaks, a wattled crone, and a tent that smelled of death. The crone's tent was dark, with a tall peaked roof. She did not want to go in, no more than she had wanted to at 10, but the other girls were watching her, so she could not turn away. They were three in the dream, as they had been in life. Fat Jane Farman hung back as she always did. It was a wonder she had come this far. Malara Heatherspoon was bolder, older, and prettier in a freckly sort of way. Wrapped in rough-spun cloaks with their hoods pulled up, the three of them had stolen from their beds and crossed the tawny grounds to seek the sorceress. Malara had heard the serving girls whispering how she could curse a man or make him fall in love, summon demons, and foretell the future. In life, the girls had been breathless and giddy, whispering to each other as they went, as excited as they were afraid. The dream was different. In the dream, the pavilions were shadowed, and the knights and serving men they passed were made of mist. The girls wandered for a long while before they found the crone's tent. By the time they did, all the torches were guttering out. Circe watched the girls huddling, whispering to one another. "Go back," she tried to tell them. "Turn away. There is nothing here for you." But though she moved her mouth, no words came out. Lord Tywin's daughter was the first through the flap, with Malara close behind her. Jane Farman came last and tried to hide behind the other two the way she always did. The inside of the tent was full of smells. Cinnamon and nutmeg, pepper, red and white and black, almond milk and onions, cloves and lemongrass and precious saffron, and stranger spices, rarer still. The only light came from an iron brazier shaped like a basilisk's head, a dim green light that made the walls of the tent look cold and dead and rotten. Had it been that way in life as well? Circe could not seem to remember. The sorceress was sleeping in the dream as once she'd slept in life. "Leave her be," the queen wanted to cry out. "You little fools, never wake a sleeping sorceress." Without a tongue, she could only watch as the girl threw off her cloak, kicked the witch's bed and said, "Wake up! We want our futures told!" When Maggie the Frog opened her eyes, Jane Farman gave a frightened squeak and fled the tent, plunging headlong back into the night. Plump, stupid, timid little Jane, pasty-faced and fat and scared of every shadow. She was the wise one, though. Jane lived on Fair Isle still. She had married one of her lord brother's bannermen and whelped a dozen children. The old woman's eyes were yellow and crusted all about with something vile. In Lannisport it was said that she had been young and beautiful when her husband had brought her back from the east with a load of spices, but age and evil had left their marks on her. She was short, squat, and warty, with pebbly greenish jowls. Her teeth were gone and her dugs hung down to her knees. You could smell sickness on her if you stood too close, and when she spoke her breath was strange and strong and foul. "Begone," she told the girls in a croaking whisper. "We came for a foretelling," young Circe told her. "Begone," croaked the old woman a second time. "We heard that you can see into the morrow," said Malara. "We just want to know what men we're going to marry." "Be gone," croaked Maggie a third time. "Listen to her," the queen would have cried if she had her tongue.
You still have time to flee. Run, you little fools! The girl with the golden curls put her hands upon her hips. Give us our foretelling, or I'll go to my lord father and have you whipped for insolence. Please, begged Malara, just tell us our futures, then we'll go.
Some are here who have no futures, Maggie muttered in her terrible deep voice. She pulled her robe about her shoulders and beckoned the girls closer. Come, if you will not go. Fools, come, yes. I must taste your blood.
Malara paled, but not Circe. A lioness does not fear a frog, no matter how old and ugly she might be. She should have gone. She should have listened. She should have run away. Instead, she took the dagger Maggie offered her and ran the twisted iron blade across the ball of her thumb. Then she did Malara, too. In the dim green tent, the blood seemed more black than red. Maggie's toothless mouth trembled at the sight of it.
Here, she whispered. Give it here.
When Circe offered her hand, she sucked away the blood with gums as soft as a newborn babe's. The queen could still remember how queer and cold her mouth had been.
3 questions may you ask, the crone said, once she'd had her drink. You will not like my answers. Ask, or begone with you.
Go,
the dreaming queen thought. Hold your tongue and flee. But the girl did not have sense enough to be afraid.
When will I wed the prince? She asked. Never. You will wed the king.
Beneath her golden curls, the girl's face wrinkled up in puzzlement. For years after, she took those words to mean that she would not marry Rhaegar until after his father Ares had died.
I will be queen, though,
asked the younger her.
Aye, Malice gleamed in Maggie's yellow eyes. Queen, you shall be, until there comes another, younger and more beautiful, to cast you down and take all that you hold dear.
Anger flashed across the child's face. If she tries, I will have my brother kill her. Even then, she would not stop, willful child as she was. She still had one more question due her, one more glimpse into her life to come. Will the king and I have children? She asked.
Oh, aye. 6 and 10 for him, and 3 for you.
That made no sense to Circe. Her thumb was throbbing where she'd cut it, and her blood was dripping on the carpet. How could that be? She wanted to ask, but she was done with her questions. The old woman was not done with her, however.
Gold shall be their crowns, and gold their shrouds, she said, and when your tears have drowned you, the Valonqar shall wrap his hands about your pale white throat and choke the life from you.
What is a Valonqar? Some monster?
The golden girl did not like that foretelling.
You're a liar and a warty frog and a smelly old savage, and I don't believe a word of what you say. Come away, Malara. She is not worth hearing.
I get 3 questions, too,
her friend insisted. And when Circe tugged upon her arm, she wriggled free and turned back to the crone.
Will I marry Jaime?
She blurted out.
You stupid girl,
the queen thought, angry even now.
Jaime does not even know you are alive.
Back then, her brother lived only for swords and dogs and horses, and for her, his twin.
Not Jaime, nor any other man, said Maggie. Worms will have your maidenhead. Your death is here tonight, little one. Can you smell her breath? She is very close.
The only breath we smell is yours, said Circe.
There was a jar of some thick potion by her elbow sitting on a table. She snatched it up and threw it into the old woman's eyes. In life, the crone had screamed at them in some queer foreign tongue and cursed them as they fled her tent. But in the dream, her face dissolved, melting away into ribbons of grey mist, until all that remained were 2 squinting yellow eyes, the eyes of death.
The Valonqar shall wrap his hands about your throat, the queen heard.
But the voice did not belong to the old woman.
The hands emerged from the mists of her dream and coiled around her neck, thick hands and strong. Above them floated his face, leering down at her with his mismatched eyes. "No!" the queen tried to cry out, but the dwarf's fingers dug deep into her neck, choking off her protests. She kicked and screamed to no avail. Before long, she was making the same sound her son had made, the terrible thin sucking sound that marked Joff's last breath on earth. She woke gasping in the dark with her blanket wound about her neck. Circe wrenched it off so violently that it tore and sat up with her breasts heaving. "A dream," she told herself. "An old dream and a tangled coverlet, that's all it was." Taena was spending the night with the little queen again, so it was Dorcas asleep beside her. The queen shook the girl roughly by the shoulders. "Wake up and find Pycelle. He'll be with Lord Giles, I expect. Fetch him here at once." Still half asleep, Dorcas stumbled from her bed and went scampering across the chamber for her clothing, her bare feet rustling on the rushes. Ages later, Grand Maester Pycelle entered shuffling and stood before her with bowed head, blinking his heavy-lidded eyes and struggling not to yawn. He looked as if the weight of the huge maester's chain about his wattled neck was dragging him down to the floor. Pycelle had been old as far back as Circe could remember, but there was a time when he had also been magnificent, richly clad, dignified, exquisitely courteous. His immense white beard had given him an air of wisdom. Tyrion had shaved his beard off, though, and what had grown back was pitiful, a few patchy tufts of thin, brittle hair that did little to hide the loose pink flesh beneath his sagging chin. "This is no man," she thought, "only the ruins of one. The black cells robbed him of whatever strength he had, that and the imp's razor." "How old are you?" Circe asked abruptly.
84, if it please your grace."
"A younger man would please me more." His tongue flicked across his lips. "I was but 42 when the conclave called me. Caith was 80 when they chose him, and Elendor was nigh on 90. The cares of office crushed them, and both were dead within a year of being raised. Merion came next, only 66, but he died of a chill on his way to King's Landing. Afterward, King Aegon asked the Citadel to send a younger man. He was the first king I served, and Tommen shall be the last. I need a potion from you, something to help me sleep. A cup of wine before bed will often—" "I drink wine, you witless cretin. I require something stronger, something that will not let me dream."
Your grace does not wish to dream."
"What did I just say? Have your ears grown as feeble as your cock? Can you make me such a potion, or must I command Lord Qyburn to rectify another of your failures?"
"No, there is no need to involve Qyburn. Dreamless sleep. You shall have your potion."
"Good. You may go." As he turned toward the door, though, she called him back. "One more thing. What does the Citadel teach concerning prophecy? Can our morrows be foretold?" The old man hesitated. One wrinkled hand groped blindly at his chest, as if to stroke the beard that was not there. "Can our morrows be foretold?" he repeated slowly. "Mayhaps. There are certain spells in the old books. But your grace might ask instead, should our morrows be foretold? And to that I should answer, no. Some doors are best left closed. See that you close mine as you leave." She should have known that he would give her an answer as useless as he was. The next morning she broke her fast with Tommen. The boy seemed much subdued. Ministering to Pate had served its purpose, it would seem. They ate fried eggs, fried bread, bacon, and some blood oranges newly come by ship from Dorne. Her son was attended by his kittens. As she watched the cats frolic about his feet, Circe felt a little better. "No harm will ever come to Tommen whilst I still live." She would kill half the lords in Westeros and all the common people, if that was what it took to keep him safe. "Go with Jocelyn," she told the boy after they had eaten. Then she sent for Qyburn. "Is Lady Felice still alive?"
"Alive, yes.
perhaps not entirely comfortable.
I see. Circe considered a moment. This man, Bronn, I cannot say I like the notion of an enemy so close. His power all derives from Lully's. If we were to produce her elder sister...
Alas, said Qyburn, I fear that Lady Felice is no longer capable of ruling Stokeworth, or indeed of feeding herself. I have learned a great deal from her, I am pleased to say, but the lessons have not been entirely without cost. I hope I have not exceeded your Grace's instructions.
No. Whatever she had intended, it was too late. There was no sense dwelling on such things. It is better if she dies, she told herself. She would not want to go on living without her husband. Oaf that he was, the fool seemed fond of him.
There is another matter. Last night I had a dreadful dream. All men are so afflicted from time to time.
This dream concerned a witch woman I visited as a child.
A woods witch. Most are harmless creatures. They know a little herb craft and some midwifery, but elsewise.
She was more than that. Half of Lannisport used to go to her for charms and potions. She was mother to a petty lord, a wealthy merchant, upjumped by my grandsire. This lord's father had found her whilst trading in the East. Some say she cast a spell on him, though more like the only charm she needed was the one between her thighs. She was not always hideous, or so they said. I don't recall the woman's name. Something long and eastern and outlandish. The small folk used to call her Maggie.
Maggie?
Is that how you say it? The woman would suck a drop of blood from your finger and tell you what your morrows held.
Blood magic is the darkest kind of sorcery. Some say it is the most powerful as well.
Circe did not want to hear that.
This Maggie made certain prophecies. I laughed at them at first, but
she foretold the death of one of my bedmaids. At the time she made the prophecy, the girl was 1 in 10, healthy as a little horse and safe within the rock. Yet she soon fell down a well and drowned. Malara had begged her never to speak of the things they heard that night in the Maggie's tent. If we never talk about it, we'll soon forget, and then it will be just a bad dream we had, Malara had said. Bad dreams never come true. The both of them had been so young, that had sounded almost wise.
Do you still grieve for this friend of your childhood? Qyburn asked. Is that what troubles you, Your Grace?
Malara? No. I can hardly recall what she looked like. It is just... The Maggie knew how many children I would have, and she knew of Robert's bastards. Years before he'd sired even the first of them, she knew. She promised me I should be queen, but said another queen would come.
Younger and more beautiful, she said.
Another queen who would take from me all I loved.
And you wish to forestall this prophecy?
More than anything, she thought.
Can it be forestalled?
Oh, yes. Never doubt that.
How?
I think Your Grace knows how.
She did.
I knew it all along, she thought, even in the tent. If she tries, I will have my brother kill her.
Knowing what needed to be done was one thing, though. Knowing how to do it was another. Jamie could no longer be relied on. A sudden sickness would be best, but the gods were seldom so obliging. How then? A knife? A pillow? A cup of heart's bane? All of those posed problems. When an old man died in his sleep, no one thought twice of it. But a girl of 6 and 10 found dead in bed was certain to raise awkward questions. Besides, Marjorie never slept alone. Even with Sir Loras dying, there were swords about her night and day.
Swords have two edges, though. The very men who guard her could be used to bring her down.
The evidence would need to be so overwhelming that even Marjorie's own lord father would have no choice but to consent to her execution. That would not be easy. Her lovers are not like to confess, knowing it would mean their heads as well as hers. Unless...
The next day the queen came on Osmond Kettleblack in the yard as he was sparring with one of the Redwine twins. Which one, she could not say. She had never been able to tell the two of them apart. She watched the sword play for a while, then called Sir Osmond aside. "Walk with me a bit," she said, "and tell me true. I want no empty boasting now, no talk of how a kettle black is thrice as good as any other knight. Much may ride upon your answer. Your brother Osney, how good a sword is he?"
"Good. You've seen him. He's not as strong as me nor Osfrid, but he's quick to the kill."
"If it came to it, could he defeat Sir Boris Blount?"
"Boris the Belly?" Sir Osmond chortled. "He's what, 40, 50? Half drunk half the time, fat even when he's sober. If he ever had a taste for battle, he's lost it. Aye, Your Grace, if Sir Boris wants for killing, Osney could do it easy enough."
"Why?
Has Boris done some treason?"
"No,"
she said, "but Osney has."
Daenerys. The stench of the camp was so appalling, it was all that Danny could do not to gag. Sebastian wrinkled up his nose and said, "Your Grace should not be here, breathing these black humours." "I am the blood of the dragon," Danny reminded him. "Have you ever seen a dragon with a flux?" Viserys had oft-claimed that Targaryens were untroubled by the pestilences that afflicted common men, and so far she could tell, it was true. She could remember being cold and hungry and afraid, but never sick. "Even so," the old knight said, "I would feel better if Your Grace would return to the city." The many-coloured brick walls of Meereen were half a mile back. "The bloody flux has been the bane of every army since the Dawn Age. Let us distribute the food, Your Grace." "On the morrow. I am here now. I want to see." She put her heels into her silver. The others trotted after her. Jogo rode before her, Aggo and Ricaro just behind, long Dothraki whips in hand to keep away the sick and dying. Sir Barristan was at her right, mounted on a dapple grey. To her left was Simon Stripeback of the Free Brothers, and Marcellin of the Mother's Men. 60 soldiers followed close behind the captains to protect the food wagons. Mounted men all, Dothraki, and brazen beasts and freedmen. They were united only by their distaste for this duty. The Astapori stumbled after them in a ghastly procession that grew longer with every yard they crossed. Some spoke tongues she did not understand. Others were beyond speaking. Many lifted their hands to Danny, or knelt as their silver went by. "Mother," they called to her, in the dialects of Astapor, Lice, and Old Volantis, in guttural Dothraki and the liquid syllables of Kaas, even in the common tongue of Westeros. "Mother, please, mother, help my sister. She is sick. Give me food for my little ones, please. My old father, help him, help her, help me." "I have no more help to give," Danny thought, despairing. The Astapori had no place to go. Thousands remained outside Meereen's thick walls, men and women and children, old men and little girls and newborn babes. Many were sick, most were starved, and all were doomed to die. Daenerys dared not open her gates to let them in. She had tried to do what she could for them. She had sent them healers, blue graces, spell singers, and barber surgeons, but some of those had sickened as well, and none of their arts had slowed the galloping progression of the flux that had come on the pale mare. Separating the healthy from the sick had proved impractical as well. Her stalwart shields had tried, pulling husbands away from wives and children from their mothers, even as the Astapori wept and kicked and pelted them with stones. A few days later, the sick were dead, and the healthy ones were sick. Dividing the one from the other had accomplished nothing. Even feeding them had grown difficult. Every day she sent them what she could, but every day there were more of them, and less food to give them. It was growing harder to find drivers willing to deliver the food as well. Too many of the men they had sent into the camp had been stricken by the flux themselves. Others had been attacked on the way back to the city. Yesterday a wagon had been overturned and two of her soldiers killed. So today the Queen had determined that she would bring the food herself. Every one of her advisers had argued fervently against it, from Raznak and the Shavepate to Sir Barristan. But Daenerys would not be moved.
"I will not turn away from them," she said stubbornly. "A queen must know the sufferings of her people."
Suffering was the only thing they did not lack.
"There is scarcely a horse or mule left, though many rode from Astapor," Marcellin reported to her. "They've eaten every one, Your Grace, along with every rat and scavenger dog they could catch. Now some have begun to eat their own dead."
"Man must not eat the flesh of man," said Argo.
"It is known," agreed Ricaro. "They will be cursed."
"They're past cursing," said Simon Stripeback. Little children with swollen stomachs trailed after them, too weak or scared to beg. Gaunt men with sunken eyes squatted amidst sand and stones, shitting out their lives in stinking streams of brown and red. Many shat where they slept now, too feeble to crawl to the ditches she'd commanded them to dig. Two women fought over a charred bone. Nearby, a boy of 10 stood eating a rat. He ate one-handed, the other clutching a sharpened stick, lest anyone try to wrest away his prize. Unburied dead lay everywhere. Danny saw one man sprawled in the dirt under a black cloak, but as she rode past, his cloak dissolved into a thousand flies. Skeletal women sat upon the ground, clutching dying infants. Their eyes followed her. Those who had the strength called out, "Mother, please, Mother, bless you, Mother."
"Bless me," Danny thought bitterly. "Your city is gone to ash and bone. Your people are dying all around you. I have no shelter for you, no medicine, no hope. Only stale bread and wormy meat, hard cheese, a little milk. Bless me. Bless me."
What kind of mother has no milk to feed her children? "Too many dead," Aggo said. "They should be burned."
"Who will burn them?" asked Sir Barristan. "The bloody flux is everywhere. 100 die each night."
"It is not good to touch the dead," said Jogo. "This is noon," Aggo and Ricaro said together.
"That may be so," said Danny, "but this thing must be done all the same."
She thought a moment.
"The Unsullied have no fear of corpses. I shall speak to Grey Worm."
"Your Grace," said Sir Barristan, "the Unsullied are your best fighters. We dare not loose this plague amongst them. Let the Astapori bury their own dead."
"They're too feeble," said Simon Stripeback. Danny said, "More food might make them stronger." Simon shook his head. "Food should not be wasted on the dying, Your Worship. We do not have enough to feed the living."
He was not wrong, she knew, but that did not make the words any easier to hear.
"This is far enough," the Queen decided. "We'll feed them here."
She raised a hand. Behind her, the wagons bumped to a halt, and her riders spread out around them to keep the Astapori from rushing at the food. No sooner had they stopped than the press began to thicken around them, as more and more of the afflicted came limping and shambling toward the wagons. The riders cut them off.
"Wait your turn," they shouted. "No pushing. Back, or stay back. Bread for everyone. Wait your turn."
Danny could only sit and watch.
"Sir," she said to Barristan Selmy, "is there no more we can do? You have provisions."
"Provisions for Your Grace's soldiers. We may well need to withstand a long siege. The Storm Crows and the Second Sons can harry the Yunkishmen, but they cannot hope to turn them. If Your Grace would allow me to assemble an army..."
"If there must be a battle, I would sooner fight it from behind the walls of Meereen. Let the Yunkai try and storm my battlements."
The Queen surveyed the scene around her.
"If we were to share our food equally, the Astapori would eat through their portion in days, and we would have that much less for the siege. Danny gazed across the camp, to the many-coloured brick walls of Meereen. The air was thick with flies and cries.
The gods have sent this pestilence to humble me. So many dead. I will not have them eating corpses.
She beckoned Aggo closer.
Ride to the gates and bring me Grey Worm and 50 of his unsullied.
Khaleesi, the blood of your blood obeys.
Aggo touched his horse with his heels and galloped off. Sir Barristan watched with ill-concealed apprehension.
You should not linger here over long, your grace. The Astaporia are being fed, as you commanded. There's no more we can do for the poor wretches. We should repair back to the city.
Go if you wish, sir. I will not detain you. I will not detain any of you.
Danny vaulted down from the horse.
I cannot heal them, but I can show them that their mother cares.
Jogo sucked in his breath.
Khaleesi, no.
The bell in his braid rang softly as he dismounted.
You must not get any closer. Do not let them touch you. Do not.
Danny walked right past him. There was an old man on the ground a few feet away, moaning and staring up at the grey belly of the clouds. She knelt beside him, wrinkling her nose at the smell, and pushed back his dirty grey hair to feel his brow.
His flesh is on fire. I need water to bathe him. Sea water will serve. Marcelin, will you fetch some for me? I need oil as well for the pyre. Who will help me burn the dead?
By the time Aggo returned with Grey Worm and 50 of the unsullied loping behind his horse, Danny had shamed all of them into helping her. Simon Stripeback and his men were pulling the living from the dead and stacking up the corpses, while Jogo and Ricaro and their Dothraki helped those who could still walk toward the shore to bathe and wash their clothes. Argo stared at them as if they'd all gone mad, but Grey Worm knelt beside the queen and said, "This one would be of help." Before midday, a dozen fires were burning. Columns of greasy black smoke rose up to stain a merciless blue sky. Danny's riding clothes were stained and sooty as she stepped back from the pyres.
"Worship," Grey Worm said, "this one and his brothers beg your leave to bathe in the salt sea when our work here is done, that we might be purified according to the laws of our great goddess."
The queen had not known that the eunuchs had a goddess of their own.
"Who is this goddess? One of the gods of Gis?"
Grey Worm looked troubled.
"The goddess is called by many names. She is the Lady of Spears, the Bride of Battle, the Mother of Hosts, but her true name belongs only to these poor ones who have burned their manhoods upon her altar. We may not speak of her to others. This one begs your forgiveness."
"As you wish. Yes, you may bathe if that is your desire. Thank you for your help."
"These ones live to serve you."
When Daenerys returned to her pyramid, sore of limb and sick of heart, she found Missandei reading some old scroll, whilst Iri and Jiqui argued about Ricaro.
"You're too skinny for him," Jiqui was saying. "You're almost a boy. Ricaro does not bed with boys, this is known."
Iri bristled back. "It is known that you are almost a cow. Ricaro does not bed with cows."
"Ricaro is blood of my blood. His life belongs to me, not you,"
Danny told the two of them. Ricaro had grown almost half a foot during his time away from Meereen, and returned with arms and legs thick with muscle and four bells in his hair. He towered over Argo and Jogo now, as her handmaids had both noticed.
"Now be quiet. I need to bathe."
She had never felt more soiled.
"Jiqui, help me from these clothes, then take them away and burn them. Iri, tell Kayser to find me something light and cool to wear. The day was very hot."
A cold wind was blowing on her terrace. Danny sighed with pleasure as she slipped into the waters of her pool. At her command, Missandei stripped off her clothes and climbed in after her.
This one heard the Astapori scratching at the walls last night,
the little scribe said as she was washing Danny's back. Iri and Jigwe exchanged a look.
No one was scratching, said Jigwe. Scratching? How could they scratch? With their hands, said Miss Andy, the bricks are old and crumbling. They are trying to claw their way into the city.
This would take them many years, said Iri. The walls are very thick. This is known.
It is known, agreed Jigwe. I dream of them as well.
Danny took Miss Andy's hand.
The camp is a good half mile from the city, my sweetling. No one was scratching at the walls.
Your Grace knows best, said Miss Andy. Shall I wash your hair? It's almost time. Resnick Moresnick and the Green Grace are coming to discuss
the wedding preparations. Danny sat up with a splash. I'd almost forgotten.
Perhaps I wanted to forget.
And after them I am to dine with Histar, she sighed.
Iri, bring the green tokar, the silk one fringed with mirish lace.
That one was being repaired, Khaleesi. The lace was torn. The blue tokar has been cleaned.
A blue, then. They will be just as pleased.
She was only half wrong. The priestess and the seneschal were happy to see her garbed in a tokar, a proper Miranese lady for once. But what they really wanted was to strip her bare. Daenerys heard them out, incredulous. When they were done, she said,
I have no wish to give offence, but I will not present myself naked to Histar's mother and sisters.
But, said Resnick Mo Resnick, blinking, but you must, your worship. Before a marriage, it is traditional for the women of the man's house to examine the bride's womb and her female parts, to ascertain that they are well-formed and
fertile,
finished Galaze Galare.
An ancient ritual, your radiance. Three graces shall be present to witness the examination and to say the proper prayers.
Yes, said Resnick, and afterwards there is a special cake, a women's cake, baked only for betrothals. Men are not allowed to taste it. I'm told it's delicious. Magical.
And if my womb is withered and my female parts accursed, is there a special cake for that as well?
Histar, Sir Lorik, may inspect my woman's parts after we are wed.
Khal Drogo found no fault with them. Why should he? Let his mother and his sisters examine one another and share the special cake. I shall not be eating it. Nor shall I wash the noble Histar's noble feet.
Magnificence, you do not understand, protested Resnick. The washing of the feet is hallowed by tradition. It signifies that you shall be your husband's handmaid. The wedding garb is fraught with meaning, too. The bride is dressed in dark red veils above a tokar of white silk, fringed with baby pearls.
Ah, the queen of the rabbits must not be wed without her floppy ears. All those pearls will make me rattle when I walk.
The pearls symbolize fertility. The more pearls your worship wears, the more healthy children she will bear.
Why would I want 100 children?
Danny turned to the Green Grace.
If we should wed by Westerosi rites, the gods of Gis would deem it no true union.
Galaza Galare's face was hidden behind a veil of green silk. Only her eyes showed, green and wise and sad.
In the eyes of the city, you would be the noble Histar's concubine, not his lawful wedded wife. Your children would be bastards. Your worship must marry Histar in the Temple of the Graces with all the nobility of Meereen on hand to bear witness to your union.
Get the heads of all the noble houses out of the pyramids on some pretext, Dariahud said. The dragon's words are fire and blood.
Danny pushed the thought aside. It was not worthy of her.
As you wish, she sighed. I shall marry Histar in the Temple of the Graces, wrapped in a white tokar fringed with baby pearls. Is there anything else?
"'One more small matter, your worship,' said Resnick. "'To celebrate your nuptials, it would be most fitting "'if you would allow the fighting pits to open once again. "'It would be your wedding gift to Hisdar and to your loving people, "'a sign that you had embraced the ancient ways and customs of Merin,
"'and most pleasing to the gods as well,'
the Green Grace added "'in her soft and kindly voice.
"'A bride price paid in blood.'
"'Daenerys was weary of fighting this battle. "'Even Ser Barristan did not think she could win.
"'No ruler can make a people good,' Selmy had told her. "'Baelor the Blessed prayed and fasted "'and built the Seven as splendid a temple "'as any gods could wish for. "'Yet he could not put an end to war and want.' A queen must listen to her people,
Dany reminded herself.
After the wedding, Hisdar will be king. Let him reopen the fighting pits if he wishes. I want no part of it.
Let the blood be on his hands, not mine. She rose.
If my husband wishes me to wash his feet, he must first wash mine. I will tell him so this evening.
She wondered how her betrothed would take that. She need not have been concerned. Hisdar Zolorek arrived an hour after the sun had set. His own tokar was burgundy, with a golden stripe and a fringe of golden beads. Dany told him of her meeting with Resnek and the Green Grace as she was pouring wine for him.
"'These rituals are empty,' Hisdar declared. "'Just the sort of thing we must sweep aside. Merian has been steeped in his foolish old traditions for too long.
He kissed her hand and said,
Daenerys, my queen, I will gladly wash you from head to heel, if that's what I must do to be your king and consort.
To be my king and consort, you need only bring me peace. Skarhas tells me you have had messages of late.
I have.
Hisdar crossed his long legs. He looked pleased with himself.
Yunkar will give us peace, but for a price. The disruption of the slave trade has caused great injury throughout the civilized world. Yunkai and her allies will require an indemnity of us, to be paid in gold and gemstones.
Gold and gems were easy.
What else? The Yunkai will resume slaving as before. Astapor will be rebuilt as a slave city. You will not interfere.
The Yunkai resumed their slaving before I was 2 leagues from their city. Did I turn back? King Cleon begged me to join with him against them, and I turned a deaf ear to his pleas. I want no war with Yunkai. How many times must I say it? What promises do they require?
Ah, there is the thorn in the bower, my queen, said Hisdar Zolorek. Sad to say, Yunkai has no faith in your promises. They keep plucking the same string on the harp about some envoy that your dragon set on fire.
Only his tokar was burned, said Dany scornfully. Be that as it may, they do not trust you. The men of New Gis feel the same. Words are wind, as you yourself have so oft said. No words of yours will secure this peace for Merion. Your foes require deeds. They would see us wed, and they would see me crowned as king, to rule beside you.
Dany filled his wine cup again, wanting nothing so much as to pour the flagon over his head and drown his complacent smile.
Marriage or carnage? A wedding or a war? Are those my choices?
I see only one choice, Your Radiance. Let us say our vows before the gods of Gis, and make a new Merian together.
The queen was framing her response when she heard a step behind her. Oh, the food, she thought.
Her cooks had promised her to serve the noble Hisdar's favourite meal, dog in honey, stuffed with prunes and peppers. But when she turned to look, it was Ser Barristan standing there, freshly bathed and clad in white, his long sword at his side.
"'Your Grace,' he said, bowing, "'I am sorry to disturb you, "'but I thought that you would want to know at once. "'The Stormcrows have returned to the city.
with word of the foe. The Yunkish men are on the march, just as we had feared. A flicker of annoyance crossed the noble face of Hisdar Zolorik. The queen is at her supper. These sellswords can wait. Sir Barrister ignored him. I asked Lord Dario to make his report to me, as your grace had commanded.